First of all,
we have pensions tonight.
Oh, yeah. That, okay.
It isn't on my calendar.
It should be. Okay.
The joint hearing of the public safety, the judiciary budget and judiciary policy committee will come to order.
Okay.
Today is Tuesday, February the 16th. Members, today we have two presentations reporting back to us. The first one, we're going to hear from the Legislative Auditor's Office on their review of the public defense system. And then we're going to hear back from a work group that we asked to convene to do some work on for us on the criminal and juvenile justice system, and in particular the juvenile justice system's decision point study that we put together last session. So I think it would be very interesting, and I thank all of you for making the time to be here. And so first on our agenda will be Mr. Nobles.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the Joint Committee. My name is Jim Nobles. I'm the Legislative Auditor for the State of Minnesota. With me at the table is KJ Starr and Deb Chenaud.
Mr. Nobles, can you pull that a little bit closer to you?
Madam Chair and members, is that better?
A little bit closer, and then can you tilt it up a little bit? You're taller than me, so.
All right.
Everybody is.
For the record, Senator Betzel says everybody is taller than me, and that is correct.
Well, not Representative Rukavina. Okay.
Mr. Nobles.
Madam Chair and members.
That's correct.
I think everyone in this room would agree that public defenders are an essential part of our criminal justice system. They fulfill a constitutional responsibility that legal counsel be provided to people who cannot afford a private attorney. In addition, public defenders can help facilitate the orderly movement of cases through our trial courts. Because public defenders are important, 18 years ago, in 1992, the Office of the Legislative Auditor evaluated the state's approach to providing public defense services to citizens who needed them. Our evaluation came just a few years after the state started a transition toward a more unified state-funded trial court system, and legislators wanted to know how public defenders were faring in that transition. In 1992, we found a troubling situation. The public defense system was experiencing significant financial stress and organizational conflict. Some of that conflict resulted from judges and local officials who were resisting the whole movement toward a state trial court system. I think it is fair to say that 18 years ago, in 1992, the state's ability to effectively create and manage a statewide public defender system was still in question. 18 years later, OLA is back with another evaluation. And as is often the case with our evaluations, again, our results are mixed. For example, we did not find that we have achieved uniformity in administrative practices at the trial court level, especially as they make decisions about providing public defense services. Judges and local court administrators still have their own way of doing things, and in some instances, that has a significant impact on public defenders. Nevertheless, we have some positive things to say as well. The Board of Public Defense and the Chief Public Defender, Mr. Stewart, and the Chief Administrator, Mr. Kyer, have made real progress in creating and managing a much more unified statewide public defender system. But the financial pressures they face have not abated since our 1992 evaluation. In fact, the financial stress has gotten much worse. And many of the management improvements that we think need to be made still will be difficult to make without additional resources. To tell you more about the progress and the problems that we found, let me call on Deborah Chenaud, who was the manager of this evaluation. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Nobles. Ms. Chenaud, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Deborah Chenaud. I'm a project manager with the Office of the Legislative Auditor. And before I begin, I'd like to again recognize KJ Starr, the other member of this evaluation team who did some great work on this evaluation. Let me start with where we're going. Our key findings include that practices for appointing a public defender and ordering cost sharing are inequitable around the state. High public defender workloads are impeding the quality of representation the public defenders can provide and impeding court efficiency. Supervision of public defenders needs to be strengthened, and the risks associated with Minnesota's heavy reliance on part-time public defenders need to be addressed. I'll come back to each of these issues, but let me set the stage with some basics. The right to legal representation derives from both the federal and the state constitution. Our evaluation focused exclusively on state public defense. In Minnesota, the right to public defense applies to those who are unable to afford a private attorney. Public defenders are available in criminal matters with a chance of incarceration, juvenile delinquency cases, and child protection cases. Public defenders represent adults and juveniles age 10 and over. Minnesota has a statewide public defender system, and if you'll turn in your reports to page 19, there's a map that shows that Minnesota's administration of the public defender system is divided into 10 districts, and there is an appellate division as well.
Maybe a couple of
them. Letting everyone catch up. Page 19, big map. The office has, public defender system has 29 offices around the state. There's a main office in each of the districts and then satellite offices as well. These offices are important. They house supervisors and support functions. Minnesota has about 450 public defender attorneys. About half of them are part-time and half are full-time. In Minnesota, a part-time public defender generally has some private practice on the side, or in addition to their public defense work. They work under contract for a minimum number of hours with the state, generally 50 or 75% time. And part-time public defenders in Minnesota are included in the same labor contract that the full-time defenders are. As I said earlier, we had some concerns about the process of appointing a public defender. So let me turn now to what Minnesota law says about eligibility. Importantly, the responsibility for appointing a public defender rests with district court judges. The key standard in Minnesota is inability to afford counsel. And there are two ways under our laws to meet that requirement. Recipients of means-tested government assistance programs are automatically eligible. That applies to the defendant, and also if a dependent of the defendant who resides in the household is on means-tested government assistance. The amount doesn't matter. This is a yes-no kind of eligibility factor. The second way to qualify is for a judge to determine that a defendant cannot pay through any combination of liquid assets and current income. State law provides for two kinds of cost sharing for public defender clients. There is a $75 copay requirement for all public defender clients, unless the judge waives that copayment. There's a second kind of copayment in which a judge may order those public defender clients who have some ability to pay to make a reimbursement payment to offset the costs of their public defense. Overall, we were convinced that the vast majority of public defender clients in Minnesota are very poor and can't afford the costs of a private attorney. But we did find some weaknesses in the eligibility determination process that we want to highlight. First, receipt of public assistance should be a relatively straightforward eligibility standard, but we didn't always find that to be the case. We found instances in which recipients of public assistance should have been granted eligibility for a public defender, but they were denied. There are a couple of reasons behind this. One is misunderstanding of the law by court staff. For example, we observed a court administrator who thought that the eligibility was linked only to the defendant's receipt of means-tested government assistance and didn't consider a dependent's receipt of those benefits. There is a statewide application in Minnesota, but it is not widely used, and we saw a wide variety of local applications that are structured in different ways. And some of those applications are really poorly structured to elicit this information on eligibility status. For example, they don't list all of the means-tested programs through which one might qualify, or they ask for the amount of the benefit instead of a simple "do you receive?" So that a client or an applicant who doesn't know the amount of the benefit might just skip over that rather than saying, yes, I do get food stamps or medical assistance or something like that. And that brings me to my next point, is that applicants weren't correctly reporting their own status. We reviewed a sample of applications that were submitted around the state from a variety of counties in October 2009. And we sent those applications over to the Department of Human Services and said, please check your records. Were these applicants receiving means-tested assistance in the month of October? And DHS then sent that information back to us. And among those applications we tested, over 20% of applicants were, according to Human Services, receiving means-tested benefits, but they did not report that on their own applications.
Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering if this is an example of one of perhaps many things, but if there's a standard measure for determining a means test, and it should be the same for everyone statewide, and it can be done online, why wouldn't we just have one place, whether it's through the state public defender's office or wherever it might be, that's screening these eligibility applications and making these decisions, and then maybe sending them back out to the county if there's more follow-up needed or a question or something. But why can't we streamline and simplify this into one? Why should we have all these every county handling this independently? Is there a reason for that?
Ms. Genode?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, the district courts are the entity where eligibility for a public defender is established. They don't have automatic data sharing with Department of Human Services or the Department of Employment and Economic Development to get wage information, for example. So they don't have any mechanisms for tapping into eligibility decisions made elsewhere. It's simply not a possibility right now. And, you know, we have a lot of different programs in Minnesota, as you said, that are means tested or relate to other programs that are means tested, as in this case. And the mechanisms for easy communication simply don't exist in state government right now. Not to say that they shouldn't.
Ms. Genode, you did say that there is one application that has been developed to be used statewide. But in your review, it is not being used statewide, correct?
Correct. There is an application form that the law directs the state public defender to develop, and in fact he has, and that has been disseminated, but there are many district court jurisdictions that choose to use their own application instead of the statewide application. One of the recommendations, I'll foreshadow this, one of the recommendations we make is that the law require use of that statewide application and that there be clearer instructions regarding what counts as means-tested eligibility benefits for the purposes of getting a public defender, to make that very clear to applicants and also to court staff about what qualifies and what doesn't.
Madam Chair, if I could just expand.
Mr. Nobles.
You might want to look on page 52 and thereafter, where we deal in some detail with what was found out at the district court level in terms of how eligibility determinations are made. And I think it's fair to say from what we found and what we characterized, particularly in the bulleted statements on page 52 and then over on page 53 as well, where we, or 54, where we point specifically to the individual attitudes of judges as coming into play here. in terms of the application of the law and those eligibility determinations. I think this just reflects where we are in what I referred to earlier in my opening statements in our efforts to achieve a unified state trial court system. We're simply not there yet. It's been a number of years now since we've been moving in that direction, but I think this report, although it certainly is not a comprehensive examination of the district court system, it is certainly a window into that system on this particular service. And again, what it shows is that whatever laws you pass, judges still rule their courtrooms. And individual district and even county-based administration of the court system has an impact.
Thank you. Ms. Janot, please continue.
One other issue related in this arena, we saw public assistance recipients who were subjected to unnecessary additional screening once they had established their eligibility as a means-tested public assistance recipient. For example, court staff would continue to ask about income and other factors that really weren't relevant at the point that they had already stated their categorical eligibility. The second way to qualify for a public defender, as I said, is for a judge to evaluate an applicant's financial situation and determine that he or she could not reasonably afford a private attorney. State law allows judges considerable discretion in doing that. The law establishes factors that the judges are to consider, including income, assets that could be converted to cash or used to secure a loan. But judges' reports to us show that they weigh eligibility factors very differently. For example, some judges took calculated income from the application and compared that to federal poverty guidelines. Judges in other jurisdictions did not. Some judges offset income based on household expenses. Other judges did not. Some judges placed a lot of weight on ownership of a primary residence. Other judges didn't consider this factor at all in making their determinations. In addition, the level of scrutiny applied to applications varied widely, from virtual rubber stamping in some jurisdictions to routine, brief, face-to-face interviews that took place with applicants in other jurisdictions. And in the end, we heard from judges that they're often relying on gut instinct when they make their decisions to appoint or not appoint a public defender. I'm going to turn now to the practice of ordering public defender clients to make a reimbursement payment to the state. And again, in this context, I'm not talking about the $75 copayment. I'm talking about the additional reimbursement that clients with some financial means may be required to pay for the state. Over the last 3 years, the amount of these reimbursement orders has been about $500,000 a year, $500,000 a year. And not surprisingly, some judges are far more likely to order these reimbursements than others. To get some relative sense among the districts, we took the total amount of reimbursement dollars ordered over a 3-year period and divided that by the number of cases in each district to get a sense of relative use. And as you can see here, the second and fourth districts, that's Ramsey and Hennepin counties, very rarely order reimbursements, whereas in the fifth and eighth districts, judges were more likely to. There are other reasons besides the judge's propensity why these numbers might differ, but it really does, I think, corroborate what we heard, and that is that judges very much have different attitudes about ordering of these reimbursements. There's a ripple effect from that. State law allocates these reimbursement dollars to the Board of Public Defense, and they are to be then provided as payments to offset overhead costs for part-time public defenders. And not surprisingly, payments per part-time public defender vary widely because the reimbursements that are ordered in a district, they stay in that district. So the extent to which judges will order reimbursements and the number of part-time public defenders in that district really affect how much each receives. And you can see here that in 2009, it ranged from nothing to over 9 $1,000 per public defender. As I said earlier, we are convinced that most public defender clients are very poor and can afford representation. But it is important that Minnesota demonstrate some equal application of the law and to continue to move forward in our statewide court system. And to that end, we make a number of recommendations to the legislature. First, we think that you should set fixed income standards and clarify those circumstances that should warrant a judicial waiver of the standards. Strengthen procedures granting automatic eligibility to recipients of public assistance and exempt them from paying any reimbursement. Set standards for who should be required to make reimbursement payments and for how much. And require use of a uniform application and some kind of face-to-face screening of public defender applicants. And finally, we think that you should grant authority for the public Board of Public Defense to continue to receive those reimbursement dollars, but allow the board to use those dollars as it sees fit, rather than earmarking them specifically for payments to part-time public defenders. Let me turn now to workloads, another key question that we had from many legislators. Workloads are too high in Minnesota's public defender system. Caseloads are double national standards. When we surveyed judges and public defenders, 60% said that public defender workloads in 2009 were much higher than in 2002. Though that same theme was echoed by prosecutors and court administrators, just to a little lesser degree. We also saw that the stress in Minnesota's public defender system during our site visits. We shadowed 8 public defenders in metro and rural Minnesota jurisdictions, and the pace was really incredible. And I'll come back to that a little more in a minute. The biggest factor influencing workloads is the loss of public defender attorneys. In 2008, cost-saving actions resulted in the loss of about 50 attorney FTEs. As you can see, in May 2007, there were about 429. This is full-time equivalent attorneys, down to 376 as of May 2009. There are other factors that influence workloads, and we talk more about that in the report. For example, the severity of consequences attached to crimes has grown. And as civil and criminal consequences rise, clients have a greater interest in keeping their case going. They're less likely to settle for less than what they want. And public defenders need to provide more zealous advocacy. That all takes time. In 2008, the Board of Public Defense assessed its priorities. And it approved a number of actions to deal with these staff reductions. We think those actions were both reasonable and appropriate. The board eliminated non-mandated services. In particular, public defenders stopped representing parents in child protection cases, and the burden for that representation shifted to counties. I'm sure you've probably all heard about that change. They reduced participation in specialty courts, again, only to those proceedings that are where it's mandated that the public defender be there. They implemented scheduling controls, for example, by not sending in some areas public defenders to arraignment hearings, but waiting for the next appearance. And they prioritized case assignments, placing top priority on in-custody clients and those charged with the more serious crimes, you know, misdemeanors at the bottom. And to a great extent, our surveys and site visits really focused on how this played out on the front lines. And it really comes down to time. Public defenders have insufficient time with their clients. That means insufficient time to build trust with their clients, to explain the system and the charges, to discuss possible options, and to make decisions. It means less time preparing cases, interviewing witnesses, requesting investigative support, drafting motions, doing legal research, and all the other things required to prepare for hearings and trials. In one jurisdiction, we observed one morning a public defender with a stack of new cases. And she ended up having 10 minutes per client to go through each of these cases. That was 10 minutes for introductions, evaluating the case, explaining to this client what his or her options were, what the consequences were, and discussing possible plea deals. At the end of the 10 minutes, the public defender said, "So what do you want to do?" And this was moving like this, case after case.
Ms. Janelle, we have a question for you. Senator Foley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Curious and hoping that you will continue to explain how much time and what types of cases that might deal with and so forth. So it gives us a little better interpretation of what they are. And
excuse me, Senator Foley, we can't hear you.
It's three.
Talk right into it.
If you just lean closer, Senator Foley.
There's nothing there.
Yeah.
to jump back then, I'm interested in the time spent and the time preparing the cases and so forth. It seems to me that the public defender in most of the areas I've been in don't have adequate time to deal with that. You like care to comment on that?
Ms. Janot?
Madam Chair and Senator Foley, you're correct that different kinds of cases take different amount of time. And the state of Minnesota, like most other jurisdictions, uses a weighted caseload standard. So when they're allocating cases out among public defenders, they'll give, you know, a public defender can handle more misdemeanor cases than gross misdemeanor or felony cases. So their caseloads will take into account, to the extent possible, the different level of effort that's going to be involved. But on any given morning, when new clients are coming in, those could be misdemeanors, gross misdemeanors, it could be a felony case. But then the system does try to take into account those differences and in balancing out how cases are assigned among the public defenders. But there's no getting around the fact that even using weighted case measures that take those factors into account, Minnesota's caseloads are higher than they should be.
Thank you. Please proceed.
One thing we saw clearly, continuing in this vein, that being a public defender really isn't for the faint of heart, and it's not for one with out stamina. We saw a lot of stress out there in the system taking its toll on morale among public defenders. And it's also taking a toll on the criminal justice system overall. About 50% of the judges we surveyed said that criminal cases were moving much too slowly or too slowly through their courtrooms. We also surveyed about what are the factors that are most influencing the progress of cases. And court administrators and judges said that the most significant factor behind delays was the ability to schedule public defenders. A much more important factor than the availability of judges, more important than the availability of prosecutors, more important than the total number of criminal cases flowing into the system.
Ms. Janot,
translate
it into sort of simpler terms. Judges just can't find public defenders when they need them. Is that what that means?
Madam Chair, yes. Most courts have calendars set for hearing certain types of cases at certain times. And it is possible, particularly in areas of the state where public defenders are representing clients in different counties, that they could be scheduled at the same time in a different county. Hmm. So we did hear from, in some districts that the public defender's office has been working with the bench to try to ease some of the scheduling strain because it really burdens everybody. And more efficiency in scheduling is good for public defenders and it's good for the court. But there's still progress that needs to be made in this area. As I said, we also took a general look at some management issues. And I'll run through some of those findings for you now. We think managers need to be more actively supervising assistant public defenders and observing how well they represent their clients in action. But managers in the Minnesota public defender system are generally carrying their own caseloads. That means they have a limited amount of time to perform supervisory duties. Along these same lines, we think that the office needs to develop some performance measures around, you know, what does it mean to provide quality defense for your client. Many public defenders, generally those who work part-time, are isolated without offices nearby. This limits their access to support services. As I said before, investigative and paralegal and other support is housed in those public defender offices. And there are some public part-timers, especially, who are out there without one of those offices in their vicinity. We also think the public defender's office needs to take a strategic look at the state's current reliance on part-time public defenders. Currently, outside of Hennepin and Ramsey County, about 65% of our public defenders are working part-time. Many of them have been with the public defender's office for a long time, and they are nearing retirement. We think there needs to be some forward thinking in anticipation of that wave of retirements. Resources in the system are allocated using caseload measures that are outdated and don't reflect current law and practices. And to make things even more complicated, though, the Public Defender Central Administrative Office has very lean staffing. They have little staff time available to do the kinds of things that we are recommending they do in terms of strategic planning and analysis.
Ms. Janone, can you talk a little bit about the caseload standards being outdated? What does that mean?
Madam Chair, in 1992, is that right? Minnesota contracted with a group, 1991, Minnesota contracted with a group called the Spangenberg Group, who came in and did a study of the average amount of time it takes attorneys in Minnesota to work particular kinds of cases. The base unit is a misdemeanor case. So what they did was they followed public defenders in different parts of the state and then averaged out that work time and said, okay, in Minnesota, we think a public defender should carry no more than 400 case units, or basically 400 misdemeanors. And that would translate to fewer numbers of gross misdemeanors and fewer number of felonies. But things have changed. Minnesota law is a lot more complicated, for example, in the area of sexual offender crimes. And cases take a longer and are of a different nature now than they were so many years ago. Another issue is, thank you, that I guess I need to take a drink of water because I don't
I didn't realize that was hers.
Lost my train of thought, though. Another issue is that because that caseload study averaged across the state, it didn't take into account regional differences. For example, way in outstate Minnesota, an attorney may be driving 3 hours for a case. Driving times really affect how many cases per public defender can be handled in rural areas of the state compared to metro areas. And this caseload study wasn't stratified to take any of those differences into account. So in an ideal world when resources are available, we really do think that Minnesota needs to undertake a new and updated caseload study.
Very good. Thank you.
I'll just wrap up with a few thoughts. You know, overall, the public defender system in Minnesota is under I forgot, recommendations. I got all rattled by my water drinking. We make a number of recommendations to the Board of Public Defense. First, we think they need to do some work to define the measures of what quality representation means. We think they need to strengthen supervisory practices and engage in some strategic planning. What are the state's long-term staffing needs? What is the best balance of full-time and part-time public defenders in Minnesota? And do we need additional satellite offices, particularly in more rural areas of the state? And we also think they should conduct a new caseload study when that becomes possible. And it's the when that becomes possible that really gets to the big issue. And, you know, what are our options moving forward? There really aren't any easy ones. We certainly think the Public Defender's Office can make some progress in implementing our administrative recommendations, but there is no getting around the fact that resources are an issue. Significant funding increases are unlikely, and in fact, the governor yesterday called for another reduction for the Public Defender's Office. The board itself has said its priority is on client services, and I think the state public defender will tell you that in a choice between moving or devoting any additional resources to administrative activities versus client services, they don't want to do a shift of resources that way. They want to continue to focus their resources on client service. And that leaves us on the demand side. The legislature could make policy changes that provide some relief to the public defender system and to the criminal justice system overall by dealing with policy issues related to civil and criminal consequences and other aspects of the criminal justice system. And I'm sure you've heard many recommendations in that regard. With that, I'll close, and we are open for questions.
Ms. Chenault, I have a question. You talked about the board's priority is client services. And I'm wondering if in the review, if you conducted any conversations with the bench or with clients or with other stakeholders that interacted with the board to talk a little bit about that, understanding the constraints, the caseloads, and the demands. How are they, I guess, in their ability to meet that client service priority?
Madam Chair, we surveyed public defender clients, and we also asked judges and public defenders about quality of representation. But let me direct you to page 42 of the report, table 3.5. We constructed a very simple survey for clients. It had six questions on it. And we distributed that survey to former public defendant clients through probation offices around the state. And we got 317 responses. And as you can see here, clients were generally pretty satisfied with their public defenders. 82% said, my public defender listened to me. 84% said my public defender treated me with respect. 83% my public defender explained things so I could understand. The one area that they were clearly less satisfied in a relative sense had to do with the time that their public defender spent with them. Relative to other questions, only 61% said my public defender spent enough time with me. So again, here this corroborates what we learned in other venues and through a lot of other interviews and means that, you know, time with clients is an important issue. We also asked, if you're right there, turn to page 43. These are some of the questions from our survey where we asked district judges' opinions of the quality of representation provided by public defenders. And here I'll point you to the first questions. We asked them to react to this statement. Public defenders I know spend enough time with their clients. 52% of district court judges strongly disagreed with that statement. Going down, we also asked, are public defenders appearing before you fully prepared, either for hearings or for trials? And you can see 25% of district court judges disagreed that public defenders were displaying enough knowledge of their cases. 75% yes, but 25% disagreed with that statement. And similar, the results were similar for preparation for trials.
Earlier, Madam
Senator Foley,
you had a list of judicial districts, I take it, that, and Ramsey was in one that had a zero amount in the
reimbursement.
What you're looking for, total cost.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley, were you asking about the ordered for reimbursements?
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, there's a discussion about reimbursements and some tables, wrapping some numbers around that, beginning on page 67 of the report. Table 4.6 shows the amount of reimbursement receipts and the amounts of reimbursements ordered by district. This actually runs kind of a rough collection rate, and the table shows how many reimbursement dollars were ordered, how many actually came into the system and were transferred according to the court's information system to the state. So it shows quite a bit of variation in total dollars, but also highlights a problem with the court actually collecting fees that it orders.
Any other questions for Ms. Janod? Ms. Janod, would you say that based on your review of the information and this is following up with our conversation about the quality of representation, were there any comments or any thoughts about, again, given the constraints and the quality of representation, were there any comments from the bench, from the clients, or from prosecutors expressing concerns about perhaps the increasing or the trend of inability of public defenders to ethically or constitutionally represent their clients?
Madam Chair, yes. We did talk with stakeholders throughout the system about that exact issue. There are two ways to think about that. There's a constitutional standard that Minnesota must provide adequate representation. For case law, or through case law, Minnesota's system would have to be entirely dysfunctional to be found constitutionally inadequate. I think a more useful measure for Minnesota and one that we should pay more attention to are the professional standards that say attorneys are required to provide competent and diligent representation. And we asked district court judges and we asked public defenders, how close to the line are we getting on that particular issue? And I would point you to page 43 of the report. I need to flip back as well. We asked district court judges, for example, whether they agreed or disagreed with this statement. Public defenders that I interacted with in the last year ran into potential ethical issues surrounding their obligation to provide competent and diligent representation. And 37% of district court judges agreed or strongly agreed with that statement. If you flip back a page, on page 41, we asked public defenders the exact same question of their own perception. Are you running into troubles providing, you know, ethical concerns? And 45% agreed that they were.
Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question about what that means, the phrase potentially ethical issues, because looking at that same page, I see that the judges say that for, they say that they, public defenders appearing in my courtroom provide constitutionally adequate representation for all of their clients. It looks like 90% of them agreed with that statement. And yet the statement right below that you already read, you know, seems to be different. So are we talking about two different things there, or what's the difference?
Ms. Janot.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, these are two levels of standard. It's very easy, relatively speaking, to provide constitutionally adequate representation. Case law, for KJ, do you have an example?
Please state your name for the record.
Sorry, KJ Starr, Madam Chair, Senator. In case law, they've had attorneys who have fallen asleep during parts of the trial and been found to provide constitutionally adequate representation. Attorneys who have used drugs during the trial have been found to provide constitutionally adequate representation. And there's general agreement in the legal community that it is a very low bar provide constitutionally adequate representation. And for that reason, we also wanted to look at professional standards for attorneys in the courtroom.
We think it's a more useful measure in Minnesota, a more meaningful way to talk about quality of representation.
Well, thank you. There being no other questions, we thank you very much for your good work, Mr. Nobles and Mr. Node and your team. Thank you very much. And
Thank you, members,
this is Mr. Node's last report to the legislature. She's moving on to good things, and we wish you the best of luck. And thank you for your great work and service to Minnesota.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
We have our state public defender and our chief administrator here to give us a response and a reaction to this. My sense is, gentlemen, that you weren't that surprised by some of these findings, because I think that we've been hearing that from you for quite a while. So, again, thank you for being here, and please, whoever would like to speak, please just state your name for the record.
Madam Chair and members, for the record, my name is Kevin Kyer. I'm the Chief Administrator with the Board of Public Defense. To my right is John Stewart, the State Public Defender, and to my left is Laura Budd, who is the Chair of the Board of Public Defense. I think the Chair has it right. I think there's nothing surprising in here. I think you all have heard it, or some of you that have been in court have seen it over the years, and it's always nice to have some confirmation from somebody outside on some of the things that you're talking about and doing. I'd like to reiterate what the Chair said. Thank Mr. Nobles and his staff. I think they were very professional and did their job with a good deal of humor as well, which in this day and age I think we need. Just a couple of clarifications, just so that the committee's not misinterpreting some things. On screen number four, I think Ms. Janad talked about the public defenders being part-timers being contractors or contract. They are, in fact, state employees. They are a member of the bargaining unit and entitled to state benefits just like any other part-time employee would be. So I don't want the committee to maybe misinterpret that. Number two, on screen number 10, they talked about the collection of reimbursements coming to the board, and then we distribute that. That distribution, I think, as she mentioned later on, is set in statute and was set by you all in terms of how those reimbursements get distributed. So the board really doesn't have any say in how those are distributed. Other than that, Madam Chair, they mentioned that the board's priority has been client services. The only other issue in terms of scheduling, if you will, I think they may have understated the scheduling conflicts, particularly in greater Minnesota, where public defenders are often, going to two different counties or three different counties in the same day. I think it happens more often than all of us would like. So you have our response. It's attached to the back of the report, and I guess we would stand for any questions the committee might have.
Any questions for Mr. Kyer or Mr. Stewart?
Madam Chair.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you just give me a rough guess of the talk about caseload and backup log, backlogging of cases?
What would be the state average? What could I go out and talk to folks when you're talking about being short of funding? How many months behind?
I just said that.
Plead not guilty. Is it 5 months, 4 months?
Mr. Kyer or Mr. Stewart? Mr. Stewart?
Madam Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, it really is different in different parts of the state. There are counties in the 10th Judicial District, which is the northern suburbs on up to Pine City, where they're scheduling close to a year out now for people who aren't in custody. And the priority of the board and the prosecutors and the courts think this is reasonable is to take care of cases of people who are already in jail first. And that means something like maybe a shoplifting or a bad check case of somebody who's living at home might go out a year. There are other places that are more caught up than that. I was in southeastern Minnesota last week, and they're running maybe 60 days out on those.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, what judicial district are you in?
7th, I believe.
What's the backlog time in the 7th Judicial District?
Madam Chair, 7th District is actually pretty good, but there are some spots that are better than others. I mean, in Stearns County, where St. Cloud is, we have a full-time office, and it's two blocks from the courthouse, and those lawyers are not driving to other counties other than maybe to make a run over to Benton County. And they're in pretty good shape. In the more rural parts of the district, out around maybe Long Prairie, Wadena, Little Falls, Ottertail County, they are more behind. I can't tell you that exactly by district, though. I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, if I might, we had a meeting just prior to this. In Olmsted County, the wait is a year plus right now for that same case. And that's the Chief Justice was just there a week or two ago, I guess, and mentioned that.
Senator Foley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just would like to know how you're dealing with felonies and how much time is devoted to them, and is that adequate?
Mr. Kyer?
Madam Chair, if I might take a stab at this, and I think we're going to talk a little bit about this in the Budget Committee next week, is as I recall, if you talk about a 40-hour week, which none of our public defenders put in, but if you look at it at a 40-hour week, we have less than 4 hours per case statewide right now. No matter the case type, so felony, misdemeanor, gross misdemeanor. That includes waiting time in the court, travel time, time to read the complaint, interview the client. You know, if you're the 15th one on the docket, you're waiting, you know, for that case. It will be, given the budget situation we're facing as of yesterday or potentially as of yesterday, it may be down to 3 hours or less. So as the auditor mentioned, if somebody's driving an hour to get to court, that means there's only 2 hours left. If they're waiting for their case to be called, you know, you can see how that's going to start to impact the system.
Senator Orman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your testimony. I appreciate the report that was prepared. We can all say that it's not surprising, but it is alarming, this trend. And I would spend 40 hours on one brief in my private practice. I mean, one motion. So it's alarming. It's a very big problem. I don't know how we begin to address it, but I know that it's reached a crisis in our courts. And I know that folks in this room would like to help. There's work to be done to help you. It's a high priority for many of us. We're all looking for solutions, including some that are less palatable than others, but we're looking for solutions. And on my own behalf, I would say I appreciate so much what you do, all of you, and what you accomplish every day for justice in the state of Minnesota. I mean, I can get on the high horse and talk a lot, but you set an amazing example by what you do every day for all of us in the state, and I appreciate so much what you do. And thank you. You don't get thanked enough, but we also need to do something about this. I would like to ask one question, though. Have any of the counties helped to defray some of the costs because they recognize what's been happening here, or are you really limited in terms of your funding from state resources?
Mr. Kyer?
Madam Chair and Senator Ortman, just to kind of take them in order to address your first comment, I guess. There's a felony case that I'm all too familiar with. But where the initial interview by a private lawyer took 6 hours. That was the initial interview with that client. That was after they were out of custody. Before that person was actually retained, they spent 6 hours with them taking notes as to the background on that. So I agree, it is a dire situation. There is one county in the state that provides funding for public defenders. And you all have heard this. Hennepin County provides somewhere between $4 and $5 million a year. And that history is a very long one. Some of you that have been around a little longer understand that. I'm not sure this is the proper venue to go into that. But that is the only county that provides funding.
Well, Senator Orman.
Madam Chair, I think it is important because I think, to their credit, the county board has stepped up and said, we need to do more here because they are recognizing that this is a crisis. And they're setting a good example. understand that it may or may not be helping in other public defender's offices. Some of those costs in Hennepin County are defraying other costs. That it's a very complicated issue, as you say. But we all have a stake in making sure that you get better funding. And I hats off to the county board in Hennepin County for getting that right. And somehow we're going to have to find a new model of funding for public defenders in the state of Minnesota, because what we have now is not working.
Mr. Kyer, for the record, did Hennepin County step up recently to do that, or was there a different reason for Hennepin County's involvement in paying for the public defender?
Madam Chair and members, that the county stepping up, first of all, I didn't mean to imply that it wasn't important, because it is, and I've reminded the commissioners of that when I visit with them, that we are very grateful for that, because it does impact the rest of the state. I mean, it clearly does, because that would be $4 or $5 million, whatever the number is, that we would have to find somewhere else. That has been a longstanding policy, if you will, by the board, who have stepped up to the plate every year since state assumption back in 1989-90. And they have been willing to do that, sometimes more willing than others. But they are pressed, just like you all are, in terms of funding and the budget problems that they're having. And, again, to their credit, they have stepped up, and they continue to do that.
Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would also join in thanking you for what you do with those kinds of time constraints. I can't even imagine. The only time I ever worked as a public defender was when I was in the military in the JAG, and just by comparison there, they always say that, you know, in the military, if you're guilty, it's the worst place to be, but if you're innocent, it's the best place to be, because you actually get such a thorough defense. But by comparison, I would get 2 or 3 weeks of time to spend on one felony level case with a lot of other investigative resources and things to go along with it. So I can certainly really empathize with that. But I think we have to be careful, Senator Ortman, about saying that we're expecting the counties to step up and do more. I made the mistake of saying at a Beltrami County Bar Association meeting that, you know, or alluding to the fact that public defenders were underpaid in comparison to the county attorneys. And the county attorneys were set me straight in terms of the fact that they actually were paid less than the corresponding public defenders. So the more we tend to move things to counties, that's just saying we're moving them to property taxes. And for counties that don't have the resources and already have a lot of pressure on property taxes, that becomes a real dilemma. And so, you know, I think at the state, if we're going to take responsibility for providing adequate public defender services, then we have to figure out how to do that. And with that in mind, I wondered, you talked about uniform state court system, that we're not there yet. And I know that this transportation issue or driving issue and scheduling issue is an even bigger issue in rural Minnesota. Is there a way, if we had a more unified system that was set up for the kind of communication we'd like to be able to see happen, where we could reduce that happening, you know, so that you could try to block between the judges and the public defender's office where people are at any given time? And could we be doing a better job of that and reduce some expenses there?
Mrs. Stewart?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I think we could do a better job, but truthfully, scheduling reform is only going to get us so far. You get to a point where you can only spread the one pat of butter over so many slices of toast, and that's kind of where we are now. There are things that would make it a little better, but really, we just don't have enough people to go around. It's really what it comes down to.
Mr. Stewart and Mr. Kyer, with respect to some of these recommendations, I haven't yet had a chance to look at your formal response, but are you in touch with the Judicial Council to look at some of these items, and are you intending to come back to us with some recommendations or an update on how you will move forward on some of these recommendations?
Madam Chair and members, I guess the question is kind of what the set of recommendations you're talking about. If you look on page 17 of the of the slide handout that the auditors presented. We have set up a committee internally to define measures of quality representation, and that's been ongoing since the fall. I think the auditors found out, as we did, that this is just not a real simple task, and so we are struggling with that a bit, but we have been meeting monthly and will continue to do that. A long-range planning group's already been set up. That was set up also early this fall, I guess it was. As we start running into some of the resource issues they talked about, there's only so many of us, and some of us are here, and so that makes it difficult to keep that on track. But I think that is those two are very important, and the board approved those, as I said, this fall. With respect to the balance of full-time and part-time defenders and the need for additional satellite offices, I can name you three places we probably need full-time offices right now. Given the budget circumstances, I just obviously don't think that's possible right now. But we are, as part of that long-range group, looking at, are there other places? Should we be moving our existing offices to different places? Maybe they're not located in the right spot. I suspect that's not probably the case, but we're still certainly going to look at that. A new caseload study would be wonderful. To take into account all of the variables that were mentioned in the draft, and I think when you go through the draft, there are a lot of variables. But you are talking about a significant expense. In 1990 or 89, the legislature appropriated $100,000 to do the last study. I cannot imagine what a study of that nature today would cost you if you start including all the variables that we're talking about. In terms of some of the other issues, the eligibility issue, Madam Chair, you know, we have brought a number of those bills forward over the last few years. I guess we stand ready to if the bench or if you all want to move forward on that issue. There is a bill from last year that we brought forward that is really mimics kind of what the recommendations are in here. I guess I would caution everybody that, as the folks from the auditor's office said, the vast majority of folks are eligible. So the question becomes, how much effort do you want to put into that, given what results you're going to get, which is probably pretty minimal. But, you know, we leave that up to you folks and the folks over in the House. So,
well, thank you both very much. And Madam Chair, Senator Ortman.
I'm so sorry to interrupt you. I just wanted to make clear for the record, I did not suggest, Senator Olson, that counties should pay for defenders. That is not what I said. For the record, I think this is as important a part of public safety funding as any other part of public safety. The state should step up and do that, and I think we need to find better alternatives for permanent funding for these groups. But I did not and don't want you to misconstrue my statements into suggesting that counties should be stepping up to pay. I did think it was important for us to note that at least one is doing that.
Very good.
Madam Chair, just to finish up, and we appreciate, first of all the support that you all have given us and the board and the kind comments. I think those really should be directed at our staff, public defenders, and our support staff, because they're the ones that are in court every day on the weekends in their offices and all that. I mean, you know, you see John and I here, but those are the folks that are actually out there, you know, doing the work and trying to get these cases resolved. I think the other one, frankly, is our board. And we've had a very good board over the years. And I don't say that just because our chair is sitting here. But it has been seven people that spend an awful lot of time and effort. They don't get paid. They get a $55 a day per diem when they're down here for meetings. And they spend countless hours helping us put together the policies and the budget and all of the other things, doing the allocations and driving an awful lot of way to do that. And they don't have to. I mean, again, it's a volunteer situation, and we've been very fortunate to have some people that have been willing to do this, do it for a number of years. And obviously that makes our job a lot easier. As I said, you see John and I, but those are the folks that set the direction. So thank you again.
Thank you very much. Thank you. And members, I wanted to acknowledge Senator Rest joined us today for this report. Senator Rest is the current chair of the Senate chair of the Legislative Audit Commission, and we're thankful that you put this forward, and thanks for being here, joining us. Thank you all very much.
Shifting gear a little bit, we're going to hear back from a study group that we convened or enacted last session, and they're going to come back to us with some recommendations. I understand that there's been some really great work done among a group of dedicated professionals all across agencies working on this project. And so to the three of you who are here, Mr. Johnson, Ms. Swayze, and Ms. Buskovic. I think I've done that before and been corrected before. So, Mr. Johnson?
Madam Chair, thank you very much. And for the record, Danette's name is much easier to spell than it is to say. I found that over the years. My name is David Johnson. Today I'm here in my capacity as Executive Director of the Criminal and Juvenile Justice Information Policy Group. The 2009 legislature passed an initiative that required the Criminal and Juvenile Justice Information Policy Group to study the feasibility of collecting and reporting summary data relating to the decisions that affect a child's status within the juvenile justice system. The legislation further required that the Office of Justice Programs provide administrative support to that study. Additionally, a minimum of 8 criteria were identified for consideration in the study. With the submission of the report, mandated to be delivered to the legislature by February 15, 2010. Present today are Ms. Danette Buskovic and Ms. Dana Swayze from the Minnesota Office of Justice Programs, who facilitated the study and prepared the report. They are here to present to you the major components of the study, information learned regarding data collected and not collected on juveniles, and to provide recommendations for consideration. I believe you will find that their work went well beyond the 8 identified criteria. The policy group hopes that you will find this report useful, informative, and an effective basis for improving Minnesota's juvenile justice data and work with youth. So with that, Madam Chair, I'll turn it over to Danette.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Madam Chair, thank you. As Dave said, the Criminal and Juvenile Justice Policy Information Group asked the study be done to look at the feasibility of collecting and reporting summary data about a juvenile status within the system. And the policy group then was required to consult with the Department of Corrections, the Office of Justice Programs, and other criminal justice agencies to get this work done. To do this, the policy group appointed OJP and the BCA to complete the feasibility study tasks. We did that with the policy group having the final approval of our recommendations. At a minimum, as Dave said, we were to identify the data elements to be collected, the decision points at which these elements should be collected, who should get the data, who should be responsible for collecting the information, and then putting together a plan to implement the data collection, reporting, and analysis, and then the costs associated with doing this. So to get this done, we convened 6 work groups over August to November of 2009. We had 59 people attend these work groups. And we identified 4 things that we really felt that we needed to do. The first was to identify those decision points. And I'm going to show you in the next slide the juvenile justice cycle that we came up with that really did inform every discussion that we had. We also then looked at all these different points and determined which were a priority, and given that, which were actually feasible to collect any information on. To do this, we had to know what sort of requirements were already out there, both at a state and a federal level. We had to know what data systems were in place and where our big gaps were. And, of course, we felt that it was our responsibility then to come up with some recommendations for improving data statewide. And we'll end the presentation with those recommendations. All right, whenever we put this graph up, people tend to gasp a little bit. But this is the juvenile justice cycle. It's usually shown in a linear fashion, with a person going in and a person going out. But really, there are myriad points at which a youth can enter and exit the system. And this circle really represents the 5 main stages of the juvenile justice system, starting with law enforcement, county attorneys, juvenile court, and probation around the circle. In the middle are detention and residential facilities. And as we were saying, each one of these points represents a decision that can be made about a youth. So what we had to do was use this information and figure out which of these were a priority and which were feasible. And we came up with sort of a scheme for doing this and sort of ranking everything. We looked at prioritization in three main ways. Is it somehow required federally or by state law? Is it needed? Does it really affect a broad range of youth? Are there severe collateral consequences associated with this decision point? Is it generalizable to youth across the state? So once we ranked them for priority, then we looked at, okay, are we already getting this data? Is there a way that we can simply improve the data that we already have? Is there a shared understanding about what this data point is? And we ranked them for the feasibility of actually collecting that data. And actually, that grid for each one of those five stages is in your report. There is a grid that ranks every decision point. So that was our approach, more or less. And what we found is there are very specific recommendations throughout our report, but overall, there are some main things that we found. For example, there's less data today that's being published than there was even 5 years ago. So now what we have to do is go directly to state agencies because reports aren't being put out and ask for the data, which is fine, except sometimes we don't have time to get the data we need. If two people ask for the same data a little differently, we have conflicting information, so it's just not readily available. There are low-level offenses that youth can be charged with or arrested for that are often grouped differently according to the system. Law enforcement has one way of grouping different status offenses, and then the courts group it differently, different status offenses. So when you look at data across the system, it's really hard to track that flow because of that. And, of course, these data systems are meant to count the work that we do, and people count work differently. So the way that an offense occurs and counted changes depending on where we're at. So arrest could be the most serious arrest, but then the county attorney could have three charges. So again, when we want to track you through the system, it gets hard because are we talking about incidents or individuals or offenses or charges? It could be different. So those are some overall data issues that permeate all the different stages. In addition, if you'll remember last year, this body did pass a policy about disproportionate minority contact in Minnesota, specifically that Minnesota should identify and eliminate barriers to racial, ethnic, and gender fairness within the justice system. And we really can't do that if we don't have good race data. And what we found in doing this study is that there's a lack of common race categories across data systems. Some places have an unknown category, some places don't. Some places allow you to pick that you're bi or multiracial, where some stages you just pick all sorts of different races. So again, tracking that through and across the stages becomes rather hard. Hispanic is not uniformly collected as an ethnicity independent of race across our state to follow the census. And at some stages, race just isn't there. That race data is not there. So Dana's going to talk about the specific findings in each chapter, but I would point out that in your report, it's sort of centered around these five stages. Each chapter is laid out the exact same way. It has an overview of that stage. It has the decision points that we deemed required and needed. If we deemed a decision point informative, we just didn't discuss it. Time did not allow for that. It has recommendations and the issues associated with each of those data points as well. We also have sections on data privacy and data use and limitations, and I'll talk about those again at the end of this presentation. There's also quite a bit of explanation about what DMC is in Minnesota and what Minnesota's rates are. And then in addition to that, we had the University of St. Thomas Law School really do some great work and some focus groups and surveys around what DMC's impact is on our community, in particular our communities of color. And finally, we do, because we want to help move the process along, we did include some best practices on race data collection and DMC analysis as well. So if there aren't any questions, I'll turn it over to Dana, who will walk us through each of these five stages.
Very good.
Good afternoon. My name is Dana Swayze. I'm a juvenile justice analyst at the Department of Public Safety Office of Justice Programs. I was a co-facilitator of the work group and also a co-author of this report. And what I'd like to do at this time is walk you through the five major stages of the juvenile justice system and point out the decision points that the work group identified as required or needed for data collection in order to have a good understanding of how our youth are moving through the juvenile justice system.
Ms. Swayze?
Yes, ma'am.
The microphones aren't really amplifying, so I'm going to ask you to project a little bit.
10-4. As I present, I am going to presume a degree of familiarity with the juvenile justice system. So if any of these decision points or the process needs clarification, please stop me and let me know as we go through. The first stage of the juvenile justice system is typically law enforcement. Typically, youth become formally involved with the system through the process of arrest. Many people, when they think of an arrest, are presuming a custodial arrangement where you're taking into custody, but the term arrest from a data collection standpoint also includes receiving a written citation. And actually, in fact, the term arrest is reserved for adults in our system. The proper term for juveniles is an apprehension. I will be referring to arrests just out of, a familiar term. But when we're looking at the total number of juvenile arrests, it's a combination of written citations received and also youth taken into custody. So the work group felt that this is the first most important number of youth to collect. And you'll see that some of these decision points are in color and are in bold, and those illustrate that they are federally required decision points where we need to collect data. It's either required by federal law or it's a requirement to receive certain federal funding for our state. So the total number of juvenile arrests is required under the Uniform Crime Report participation through the FBI. So we, as a state, participate in that. A second portion of arrests are arrests for delinquent acts only. So these would be your felonies, gross misdemeanors, and misdemeanors. And we are to collect data on those as different from non-delinquent acts. Those would be your status-level offenses. There is a federal act, the Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Act, which focuses specifically on delinquency. And in order to comply with that act, the JJDPA, we need to collect data on delinquent youth as they move pretty much all the way through the system. And the first point is the point of arrest. The work group felt that there was value in knowing what happens after an arrest, so we wanted to know how many youth are released without charges following an arrest, how many youth are referred to a formal diversion program that a law enforcement agency might have under contract or in their community, or they might offer themselves. And then another required data collection point is the number of delinquent youth who are referred to the county attorney for prosecution. So this is an arrest has occurred, and the law enforcement agency believes that they want the offense to be prosecuted. And finally, at this law enforcement stage, we need to collect the number of youth who are securely detained pending court. And again, under the Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Act, we need to be able to distinguish between youth who are held in adult jails, police lockups, and juvenile detention facilities. The Act does require that we differentiate between those three different locations, and that's because there are federal law and state statutes regarding where youth can be held and how long they can be held for certain offenses. So our key findings from the law enforcement chapter, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension houses arrest data in their central repository, which is CJRS, the Criminal Justice Records System. Local law enforcement agencies submit data to the BCA, and that gets either electronically uploaded or submitted to them. The BCA puts out an annual report of arrest data, and that's the Uniform Crime Report, the UCR. It's our state-level publication for arrest data. In that publication, there's no differentiation between youth who are cited, who receive a citation, and youth who are taken into a custodial arrest arrangement. So we get the total number of youth arrests, but we can't tease out who was taken into custody versus who basically received a ticket or a summons to appear later. Race data is collected in the Uniform Crime Report. However, Hispanic ethnicity is reported as adults and juveniles combined. So we don't, the way the UCR is presently written, we don't know how many Hispanic youth have been arrested. In addition, when law enforcement agencies report to the BCA, they do provide some information on the outcome of the arrest. And so there are codes that have this information. The UCR does not currently include that, but perhaps if we can look into these codes a little further, we'd be able to find out how many youth are released without a charge after an arrest, how many might receive a diversion, how many are placed in detention, and how many are referred for prosecution. So there is some arrest data that we can delve into further and get more information. I also felt that it was interesting that tribal law enforcement agencies do not have their arrest data reported separately from the county sheriffs. It's very common that county sheriffs will report all arrests that occur in their county on behalf of their local police agencies. Excuse me. So this is a long-standing arrangement. However, we can't look and find out what juvenile arrests are looking like in tribal communities. And this also has a fiscal implication for tribal law enforcement. If they are presenting their data to the feds, they're eligible for certain federal funding directly to their law enforcement agency. So if law enforcement were providing their data separately from the county sheriffs, they may be eligible for some federal funds to assist their department. Finally, the criminal justice record system does not have individual data from St. Paul Police and Minneapolis Police. And they have their own record systems. They submit data to the BCA as needed, but those individual arrest records are not in our state repository. So if we wanted to go in and look at, say, a certain kind of offense, we'd really be missing what is close to 25% of all juvenile arrests in the state. That's about what Minneapolis and St. Paul PDs account for combined. And lastly, the system operates on an old mainframe from the 1960s. It's no longer supported from their vendor. So we're in a situation where that system could potentially crash, and then we'll be without any arrest data, adult or juvenile.
So your conclusion for collecting information, uniform information at the law enforcement level, is that it's not doable at this point, it's feasible, it's, you know, what is the recommendation, what's the conclusion?
Well, Madam Chair, we are going to do our recommendations in total at the end.
Oh, at the end.
If that's acceptable.
That's fine. That's fine.
Any other questions before I proceed to the county attorney section?
Nope. Please proceed.
Following arrest, a referral will typically go to the county attorneys. So again, our first decision point are the number of referrals to the county attorneys from law enforcement. Again, delinquency petitions need to be pulled out of here as separate from what are children in need of protection services, that's truancy and runaway, and also as distinct from status and petty level offenses. So that's the first differentiation we need to make. The next thing that we're wanting to know are some of the discretionary decisions that county attorneys make related to charging. So specifically, we need information again on delinquency cases, but how many of these cases are being diverted from legal processing by county attorneys? So is the county attorney choosing to decline a case? Is it being transferred to a different county attorney? Have they decided to do an informal diversion, such as notifying a probation officer or a social worker that they have a pending charge? Or are they going to refer youth to a formal diversion program? The formal diversion program, it's difficult to see that it's in a different color up there, but that's in green, and that is because Minnesota state statute requires that this is a data collection point. It's not a federal data collection point, but it is a state collection point. Excuse me. So of all those cases that county attorneys choose to petition to juvenile court, again, how many are CHIPS, status offenses, and delinquency matters? And of delinquency, how many are kind of your traditional delinquency? How many are being referred for extended juvenile jurisdiction? And how many are going to be certified as adults? And then this it is federally required that we keep track of how many youth are being petitioned directly to adult court. Our key findings from the county attorney chapter is that there's no central repository for county attorney data anywhere in the state. Subsequently, there's no statewide report on county attorney cases or outcomes. And Minnesota statute requires diversion programs for county attorneys, and we don't have any comprehensive list of how many diversion programs there are or where they are. So there are some significant data gaps at the county attorney level. Again, statute requires that county attorneys submit diversion data to the BCA, and there seems to be very limited compliance with that. We did check in with the BCA, and they do receive some of that data, but it's not collected in a manner with which we could easily analyze it. So what they have, we'd really have to muddle through to find out what kinds of kids are receiving diversions from the county attorney. county attorneys, because they don't have a uniform data collection system, many of them are using different race and ethnicity categories, so these are not lining up across the state from all the county attorneys. And they, not only are they collecting it in ways that are different from one another, but also different from other system stages, so we really don't have any continuity of race and ethnicity classification. Again, when we're reporting to the feds for the Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Act, we have nine stages where we need to report data, and two of them we are unable to report data on, and those are the referrals to the county attorney and cases diverted by the county attorney. So right now we're at 7 out of 9, and we have been found in compliance with the federal act. However, chances are that the reporting recommendations are going to be getting more stringent, and we're going to have to account for why we don't have data at those two county attorney points in the future.
Ms. Swayze, does that have an implication on the amount of dollars that come to the state?
It does. Madam Chair, when we submit our data, we are currently receiving about $1 million annually, and that money is granted out to community-based organizations and also local governments, specifically for delinquency prevention. So if we are not in compliance, we lose 25% of the money, and the remaining 50% has to be used to come into compliance again. So there are some consequences for that.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Finally, county attorneys are required under the Minnesota Rules of Juvenile Delinquency Procedure to submit race data on petitions to the court. But county attorneys are saying they do not reliably receive race data from law enforcement. Therefore, they have nothing to pass on to the courts because they do not see youth or families prior to making a decision to submit a petition to court. So if the race data doesn't come to the county attorney, that may be the first gap where it doesn't continue along the process from there. Third step are juvenile courts. It's a rather complicated slide. I apologize. There's numerous decisions that can be made at the court stage. But we're starting out with the total number of petitions that are filed with the court. Again, delinquency is going to stand out as a federally required decision point. The second decision, juvenile warrants issued for failure to appear. I do want to mention that the community members felt rather strongly about this decision point. So this is a situation where obviously a youth has been has not been detained and has failed to appear for court and then has a secure warrant essentially out for their arrest. And some of our communities of color felt that this is an inappropriate response, especially because of how many obstacles there can be for youth and families to get to court. And then there's a very serious response that's not necessarily based on public safety. And so we really felt that if we can gather some information about how many warrants are issued for these youth, that would be helpful to know. Another decision point is how many youth are held in custody and then following their first appearance in court are ordered to return to custody. Again, there's a public safety determination that needs to be made. And so we need to make sure that we're using secure detention appropriately. We wanted to find some information on the number of pleas that are offered and accepted. And finally, the manner with which cases are disposed. And from this data point, cases disposed is really any outcome coming from a case. So how many cases are dismissed, are continued for dismissal. Again, how many are referred to a formal diversion program, which is a state-required data collection point. How many youth are given a continuance of adjudication or a stay of adjudication, essentially usually a period of 6 months to, quote-unquote, keep their nose clean and not have an offense go on their record, not have an adjudication. And then how many charges are proven resulting in an adjudication or an EJJ adjudication. Again, any cases that are being transferred to adult court need to be captured for federal reporting. And then finally, from our dispositions, we're wanting to know how many youth are placed on probation, placed in non-secure placement, and placed in secure placement. Youth that are going into secure placement following a court order is another federally required data collection point. So our key findings from this stage, the State Court Administrator's Office houses is a state repository for court data. and this is the Minnesota Court Information System, or MINSIS. Currently, there's no state-level publication on juvenile court cases and outcomes. There was previously an annual report which was required that was called the Delinquency Petitions Report. This was last written in 2005 using 2003 data, and in 2007 it was repealed, so they no longer have to publish this report, and this is a big data gap again. There's missing race and ethnicity data at the court level due to a lack of data coming from the county attorneys. And then the courts are trying to supplement their data, their race and ethnicity data, using a census form that they hand out when a youth first appears in court. They self-select their race and ethnicity. So they're trying to supplement some of the missing data. And then the MINSIS system is new and is operating statewide, and it may have the ability to illuminate some really interesting things, including pleas accepted, youth placed in detention, youth court ordered to secure placement, and other dispositions. So the new MINSIS system might have just a wealth of information for us on how juvenile cases are handled. That's kind of exciting. The next stage is juvenile probation. Really, the only federally required decision point here are the number of delinquent youth who are placed on probation. It's pretty straightforward. There are many discretionary decisions that probation officers make with their juvenile clients. And one that is of great interest are the total number of probation violations that a probation officer submits to the court. And these are not for new offenses, rather they're technical violations of their supervision. Similarly, we would want to know how many youth are detained in response to a supervision violation and how many are placed out of the home in a secure placement. Those decision points may be influenced by individual probation officers, by their agency culture, by the culture of the bench. So different counties can vary widely on how they respond to probation violations. And similarly, we would want to know how many youth have their EJJ revoked in response to either new charges or supervision violations. And then finally, probation is intended to be the last stage of the juvenile justice system, and so hopefully we would have some information on how many youth successfully complete probation or are otherwise discharged. And currently we get a number and a number alone. We have no demographic data, no offense level data, so we really don't know very much about youth who are completing probation currently. Our key findings from this chapter: the Department of Corrections is the state repository for probation data in the statewide supervision system. Local probation providers are uploading their data. All but Hennepin County use the same software system, which is the Court Services Tracking System. The Department of Corrections does put out an annual probation survey as the state-level publication. In that publication, adult probationers are separated out by their offense level for which they're on probation, but juveniles are not. They are just all lumped together, juvenile probation officers, juvenile probation ers, probationers. And again, in this report, Hispanic ethnicity is not reported for juveniles as separate from adults. We have all Hispanic persons on probation regardless of age. Again, there's no current measurement of those discretionary probation officer decisions related to probation violations or the use of secure detention or placement. If we were to make any changes to the data collection system, the court services tracking system would have to change, and then Hennepin County, as the one system that uses their own database, would also have to make changes to their system. So it's a bit of an obstacle. And then finally, again, there's no information disseminated on the reasons youth are discharged from probation or any of their demographic attributes. And this is the final system stage, detention in residential facilities. I touched on this in the law enforcement section, but again, we need to know the number of youth that are admitted to secure detention in jails, lockups, and detention facilities. And then we'd also like to be able to have some information on the reason that they're being admitted, so for new offenses, probation violations, or for warrants. Once again here, we would like information on the total number of youth that are court-ordered to continue in secure detention. And then the residential facilities, we need information again on being court-ordered to a secure Department of Corrections licensed bed. I do specifically highlight the Department of Corrections because the Department of Human Services also has residential beds in the state, But kids that are court-ordered to those do not apply to these data collection requirements. They have to be Department of Corrections facilities. And then the work group also felt it would be helpful to know the number of youth placed out of state in secure facilities and non-secure facilities. Finally, the key findings from this chapter, again, the Department of Corrections is the state repository for secure facility data. This is the detention information system, which is part of the statewide supervision system. Presently, there's no state-authored publication that describes the number or attributes of youth that are detained in secure detention or secure residential facilities in Minnesota. There is information in admission codes that lets us know the reasons that youth are being held and what their legal status is as they move through the system. But we don't really have any understanding of how consistently these are being used. Different facilities might use these admission codes for different reasons. So we need to look into that data more closely. The system also has trouble distinguishing between an admission for detention as opposed to a court-ordered residential admission if those two beds are in the same facility. And that happens frequently, that a facility will have both detention beds for pre-court or pre-adjudication and then also residential beds for once they've been court-ordered. And sometimes the system can't well differentiate between those. And then finally, the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission previously was charged with producing an annual report of youth held in facilities out of state. But I have been informed that their responsibility to do that has also been repealed. So here's another area where we do not necessarily have placement information on youth. If there's any other questions about these stages of the system, I'd be more than willing to answer those now, or Danette's going to move on to our recommendations.
Ms. Swayze, I have a question about the referral sources, because we consider law enforcement to be the first contact, but that's really not true, because that's once they have been once a contact with law enforcement has been initiated. Was there conversations about the referral sources, whether that's from librarians or teachers in the schools or, you know, social services, or were there any conversations about that, sort of the pre-law enforcement stage?
Madam Chair, we did have conversations about other referral sources. And arrest specifically is a law enforcement action, and so they stand alone as a law enforcement activity, more or less. When we get to the next stage, which is county attorneys receiving referrals, those referrals might come from law enforcement. They also might come directly for schools, say for truancy, or from social service agencies. So there would be a larger pool of referral sources coming in at that county attorney point. So the law enforcement point we kept pretty exclusively to arrests, though we did talk a fair amount about arrests that were taking place in schools or where police are going to schools as a
response. The demographics of the statistics with respect to referral sources ought to be captured at the county attorney point.
Yes, I would say
that's
so.
How it's reflected in the report.
Yes.
Thank you. And then anywhere in some of the decision-making points, do we distinguish between sort of the dual-track kids who may be in the juvenile justice system, but they may also be affected by the human services, child welfare system?
Madam Chair, I can say that we didn't have too much discussion about that. We definitely know that they can be involved in both systems simultaneously, but we did not have too much discussion about how to track them between two systems or as they move back and forth between them.
Okay. Any other questions about the specific decision points? Ms. Mee, you're going to move on to your recommendations.
Madam Chair. So as you can see, this ended up being a bit more complicated, I think, than what we even anticipated coming out of it. And with some feedback from the policy group, we really put our recommendations together in one part of the report. It's at the end of the report. And we put them into three categories: short-range, mid-range, and long-range goals. And our short-range goals, we have five of them, really are recommendations that constitute the lowest cost, not no cost, but the lowest cost and the most feasibility for implementation. And one of the things that we found is that even though there is less information being published, there really are some good documents out there. And what we would like is just them.
Hang on a second. Does somebody have a BlackBerry that is on top of the desk? Okay, very good. Thank you.
What we would like is a bit of an expansion in some of the reports that are currently being produced and then some reinstating of some reports. So for the BCA, who puts out the arrest data, we would like some additional juvenile justice elements related to arrest outcomes, the type of arrest, the citation versus custody, delinquency versus non-delinquency. For the State Court Administrator's Office, we'd like that juvenile petition report to be done again. For the DOC, we're asking for and recommending greater detail in the probation survey about the juveniles. And we would think that a juvenile placement report might be an interesting and important piece of information to put out there so we don't have that gap in data. The Juvenile Justice Advisory Committee every year puts out an annual report, and we are recommending that they expand the information they provide on DMC and their compliance with the Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Act. And for us, for our office, we really would like to take the role and recommend that we do sort of the big picture reporting on trend data and on youth flowing through the juvenile justice system. And of course, what we found is that a lot of this data really is already out there. What we need to do is have each agency looking at the data that they're collecting to make sure that it's valid and reliable, and then use these elements to put out a more thorough report. We also recommend that the county attorneys at least get together with the County Attorneys Association and convene to explore how to release data on the number of juveniles referred and diverted, since we have no information on that at all right now. We also recommend that they get together and think about standardizing how they collect race data, both amongst themselves and then to be in better line with the other stages of the juvenile justice system. We recommend to the policy group that they lead some of this initiative in looking at what standard race and data ethnicity collection across the state would look like, how to maybe give some guidance on reporting incidents versus individuals, and also to look at those low-level offenses and come up with some standardization around how to classify them. We don't recommend who should do this, but we think someone should at least look at what law enforcement diversion programs there are statewide and what county attorney diversion programs there are statewide as well, because we know that youth can have different opportunities to get out of the system depending on where they live, and we'd like to have a better handle on what that looks like in our state. Our mid-range goals are simply that. They would take a little bit more effort, a little bit more money. They might require legislative action or some funding. And once the policy group has done its work in looking at what a statewide standardization on race and data collection would look like, we would ask and recommend legislative support for standardizing that across the system, perhaps funding to support state and local partners to comply with this initiative so they can make changes to their data collection systems. We would think, because if the county attorneys don't get race data from law enforcement, it often just falls off and doesn't continue up the process, that there'd be legislation requiring law enforcement and schools to report race and ethnicity data on all juvenile referrals to the county attorneys. We would require that the county attorneys maintain that information in their files, and we would ask that that data be categorized as public when published in summary form. We would ask and we recommend that the BCA require tribal law enforcement to submit their own data under their own agency identifier. This might require training and assistance to sheriffs and tribal law enforcement agencies. There currently is an initiative. It's the ICARE initiative with Minnesota and Wisconsin to gather better information and arrest data from tribal agencies, and we would continue to support that work. We would ask that there be some financial support to St. Paul and Minneapolis Police Department so that their individual data goes to the BCA instead of them just reporting in summary form, so that we have one comprehensive arrest data database. And then we would recommend that the DOC make necessary changes to their detention information system so that we can meet those federal requirements to look at secure residential versus secure detention. And that the legislature might need to allocate funds to make those system modifications. We only have two long-range goals, but they're big ones. Of course, they would represent the greatest financial impact and the hardest to implement. But as Dana said, and as Dave can confirm, the CJRS system, our arrest data, is on a very old, outdated 1960s mainframe. And when it goes, we're not going to have any arrest data in Minnesota. And we use that data a lot. And I'm sure that you've gotten lots of reports with that information in it as well. So we would recommend that Minnesota transition from the CJRS system to the Minnesota NIBR system, which is the National Incident-Based Reporting System. And this is actually the system that the FBI is supporting now. They're moving away from the UCR, the Uniform Crime Reports. It's a more comprehensive way of collecting data on crime incidents. It includes victim data and time and place and all sorts of other information that can be very useful. We also recommend as a long-term goal that we create a central data repository for the county attorneys. There is a significant gap in our data because of this lack of a database. And this is, we are concerned that we will be found out of compliance with the Federal Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Act if we don't have this information in the future. So I did say that we had some additional considerations, and juvenile justice data is very sensitive, and while we do support improving individual data collection, we are recommending that all reporting and dissemination be at a summary level, and we did have this checked for data practices concerns with the Department of Administration. We are saying that our data collection standard and our reporting standard be annual. And we had a lot of discussion in our group about the importance of this data itself. I mean, this is data that's collected for agencies. It's really work data. It's about system flow and understanding workloads. But it really informs us a lot with who is going into our system, what kind of kids, what kind of charges. We can look at how policy impacts the kids that are in our juvenile justice system. It helps with evaluation. What it doesn't do is answer those why questions. Why are these phenomena happening? And that's really research. But you can't have research if you don't have that basic ground information to show you that there might be a problem. So we had a lot of discussion about that, and we think that that's an important part of the report. We encourage you to look at that piece. This data is very important. Finally, we consider those long-term goals to be sort of our data plan. It's not maybe what you anticipated, but after seeing what already is being collected and what's out there, it made the most sense to really just make some really good improvements across the different systems. We weren't able to, given the time and the complexity, do a very thorough cost analysis of any of our recommendations. We did talk to the Office of Management and Budget, and they suggested that if anything is of importance, that it would take about 6 months to explore the fiscal impact of any sort of system-wide changes that we would recommend. And our stakeholders in our groups always wanted us to emphasize, and we will, that even short-range goals that have a little impact do have a resource implication. So anything that we change will have a fiscal impact. And finally, we had a lot of people. We had 59 people who came to these meetings for 4 hours at a time, basically every other Monday. And we wanted to thank them for their work because they provided a wealth of information and insight that we never would have gotten without their dedication to this issue. So, thank you.
So qualitatively, could you share with us how the participants felt about the experience and these recommendations? Was there a sense that this was a positive experience and that it was useful and helpful beyond getting the information back to the legislature?
Madam Chair, I do think so, and I think there are probably some people in the audience here today who came because of the importance of this work. I think we had a lot of really good discussion. Dana, you can let me know if I'm misrepresenting this, about what data points were important and how to get it. And there was discussion about how important it was, given that research question at times. But I don't think there was anybody in our group who didn't find the work to be really important, given Minnesota's DMC rates and just our general lack of understanding about how kids sort of move throughout our juvenile justice system. So I think everybody had a very positive experience. We were very pleased with the level of commitment that people had. We got a lot of feedback to the report. I think we made a lot of changes based on that feedback, and I think people found it very, very important and very useful.
Mr. Johnson, could you just can you just share with us, because the word DMC or the acronym DMC has been used throughout the presentation. I wonder if you could speak from JJAC's perspective the significance of that and why it's important for us as lawmakers to be aware of that.
Madam Chair and members, I'm not an expert on that, but I can give you my understanding of it and why it's important. A disproportionate minority contact would seem to indicate that there's a functional problem within the framework of an individual enterprise. And in that problem is, in some fashion, having a negative impact or a disproportionate impact on communities of color. And they become overrepresented in the various actions taken by the criminal justice system. So it's important to understand when those issues arise, when they become evident for folks like Dana and Danette and the legislature itself to go back in and say, I see this difference. Now, what is causing that? And it's the what is causing that is really the public policy concern and what can be addressed, to get to the bottom of that. And so that's why I think it's important. And what this study highlights is that in order to make good policy decisions and really understand what is impacting the youth and the communities of color, you need to have complete, thorough, and accurate data and then have that data vetted and so you can draw supportable and good conclusions for policy-based decisions.
But for any of our panelists, isn't that a fundamental, a core requirement of the federal money that we get in this state, that we address DMC rates in the state of Minnesota, or else our federal dollars are potentially at jeopardy? Mr. Johnson or Ms. Swayze?
Yes, Madam Chair. Addressing disproportionate minority contact is one of the four core protections of the Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Act. And so most of those data points that were up there in red as federally required points do come from the DMC requirement. So not only do we have to report that data, but we also have to have race and ethnicity data that goes along with that for some major race and ethnic groups. So it can be connected to that funding. We are in a position where we are submitting quarterly reports, I believe, right now on our efforts to improve our DMC reporting and rates, because we do have a rather serious issue.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, if I may, I was looking at the recommendations because I always read the ending of books, before I decide if I'm going to read them or not. It's true. It's absolutely true. And so I was back here and I saw DMC. And I thought, well, I wonder what that is. And then I went to the table of contents and I found it. And so then I went to page 23. And we have DMC, I think, in other areas as well, certainly in our schools and school disciplinary actions, expulsions, that kind of data. I've been listening since you started, but you're telling me that it's not uniformly reported in our state. I mean, we need to start. It's pretty fundamental. I mean, if this is a requirement, and it should be, then we need to know. And it's, we already know that there's this disparate contact, but there could be more than we even know there is if we were to get all the numbers. I mean, is that kind of what I'm picking up? We just don't get that in a uniform way.
Ms. Swayze?
Do we have any statutory requirement that it be uniform, or is that where you're kind of headed with this? This is quite a report. I went back to the, to the front with the legislation. Madam Chair, was this your?
It was my idea.
I remember you're talking about it, and I wondered, I wonder what kind of report that will be. It looks pretty thorough.
Yeah.
I'm impressed, but it seems that how we go to the next step is really, we have to take care of kind of the basics here and deal with accurate numbers to begin with, to know what our challenge is. I mean, we clearly have a challenge in Minnesota. If you read that on page, if you just read the copy on page 23 and 4, it's pretty alarming.
Well, Senator Scheid, I think that for a long time, among advocates and among many of our professional practitioners and our agencies, among the communities, and in particular the communities of color who have been concerned about DMC, there's been a sense that there are gaps in data and that we don't have enough information. And that so when people feel the disproportionate impact, because we don't have the data, it's hard to separate out what is a personal sense of burden and what is a result of the system acting. And I think one of the intent of this study was to say, Do we have information? What are the gaps to that information? How do we get to the information so that we can start to do the analysis, but more importantly, as an obligation to our children to say, we recognize, you know, where the inputs are, and how, what are we doing to deliver better outcomes for our kids? I mean, ultimately, that's what this is pointing to. And I think, you know, what the report is saying to me is that we definitely have gaps in the information that we're getting. And as a result of that, we don't have a complete picture of what's happening to our children in the system that we created. And so some of the recommendations says that we need to perhaps, you know, short-range, mid-range, and long-range start to look at that, plus the financial implications at the federal level. And my sense is that this administration in Washington, D.C., this presidential administration has big plans for juvenile justice. And if that's the direction where they're going, I would rather that we get in the front of the conversation so that we can ride the wave if that's the direction that they want to go. And DMC is a federal mandate that it's important for us, and they've sent money along with that. So I have to say that I am deeply grateful to all the participants who willingly came together. I want to recognize the work of the Office of Justice Programs. We didn't give them any money to do this, and they felt that it was part and parcel of the work, of their workload to do this, because in essence, my sense was that it was important to the professionals who are working with our children to do this because it mattered to their work. And even though the request came from the legislature, all the people who willingly participated felt like it was critical and crucial to the work that we do for children in Minnesota to do this. And I must say, kudos go out to all of you. And I think that this is a fabulous report, and I know that it's a little bit overwhelming right now for members of the committee. This is a lot to digest, but there will be opportunities where we hopefully, as we get to specific pieces of legislation, that we would like to invite you to come back and to bring this report back and to reemphasize for us some of the things that you found in the report. But to all the people who shall remain nameless, we owe you a great deal of thanks for the time that you've put into this report, because I think that it will be very useful. And I hope that beyond me, the chief author who put this upon you and this committee, that this does continue to highlight, and I think we'll hear that this report is very important moving forward. So thank you so much for doing this.
Madam
and
Chair.
Senator Scheib?
Madam Chair, and our grandchildren as well.
Our grandchildren. Yes.
And but at the also one of the appendices, part of the appendices is a listing of the people. I assume it's as complete as it could be, of the people who participated, and that's quite a wide variety of people who participated. And I appreciate this as well. I didn't know this was coming, and I am overwhelmed. But I have some reading material.
And members, there's an additional report that was has been handed out to you. This is the 2007 Minnesota Student Survey that it gets collected, and it's published by the Office of Justice Programs. So take this. I think this would be a nice complement to the Decision Point report. Thank you very much. Members, thank you so much for putting in the time from both committees to listen to this report. We are adjourned.
So you look at the end of the book before you...
I always do, because I want to see if the heroes are still... Because I don't like good people to get killed.
Yeah, to get emotionally involved.
Yes.